Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour, episode number 41, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
Now, hey. Joe's back.
Back from the grave.
Now, we've all been hanging out yesterday. You're very low over there. I can't see you.
I know. I put my seat down.
Avoiding eye contact.
Yeah, I don't want to look at you.
Now, we are sounding a little bit hoarse maybe today because it was, of course, a big event yesterday. At the time of recording this, we were over in Manchester.
Oh, yeah, Play Expo. And we met so many fans. It was really good. All these people were coming up to us. Oh, you're the Retro Hour boys. It's great.
Which is amazing considering we do an audio podcast.
Yeah. It's strange how they recognised it.
I felt really rude because if Dan was like, oh, Joe, this is some fans. And I was just like, I'm playing House of the Dead.
So I was not even bothered. But not only did we meet, you know, loads of amazing listeners, but also we hung out with guys like, you know, John Hare was there and Mev Dinker we had on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, we spoke to him on Skype and now we met him in person and he's even nicer in person.
And Jeff Minter as well, we're hanging out with him for a bit.
Yeah, shown as the Spectrum Next.
That was Jim Bagley was doing that.
Oh, Jim Bagley, he just had it in his bag and then just kind of produced it and suddenly nerds emerged and gathered round.
But it was so good as well. I mean, Joe, we've been to a few retro shows, obviously, with you over the last year. What did you think of this compared to the others then?
Really impressed, really impressive. Like, we went to Blackpool earlier this year, and then we went to one last year, and they've all increasingly got better. This is like my third or fourth one in the last year, and definitely the biggest one, best one. Lot on offer, a lot of stuff I hadn't seen before. So yeah, really enjoyed it. Really, really recommend it for next year.
Yeah, loads of good stalls as well. I mean, I did actually only come away with an N64 controller and a Rumble Pack and a PS2 game, which I'm quite impressed with myself.
Yeah, and you were mentioning all the alternative stuff there. They had so many pinball machines.
Yeah.
And like, you know, really cool stuff that you just don't see out these days.
Yeah, well, real good selection of just everything, to be honest.
We couldn't drag you away from the arcades, could we?
No. I kind of whipped around all the stalls, spent half my money, and then thought, right, I'll move away, because if there was a joke on who's going to break first and who's going to spend the most. Moved away, went on some arcades for a couple of hours, and then ended up going back and spending the rest of my money.
Well, you met someone, rather.
Oh, yeah. Being the 20th anniversary of Tomb Raider, they had the original model of Lara Croft, the one that we all looked in the magazines and went, ooh, as young boys.
The man was in love.
I was in love, totally.
The whole car journey the way back, every 10 seconds. Do you remember that time we met Lara Croft? Yeah, we do, Ravi. It was earlier today, mate.
I was so like in a daze that I forgot to ask her to come on the podcast. That would have been a good guess.
You're a bit weak at the knees, didn't you?
Yeah.
But we did put a load of pictures of that we took then. There will actually be a video on my YouTube channel, probably out by the time the show comes out. We'll pop a link in the show notes at theretrohour.com. So if you did come along and meet us at Play, lovely to meet you. And same time next year.
Oh, totally. And you reposted a load of photos on the Facebook as well. So,
speaking of amazing people, some nice donations this week as well in the last 7 days. Now, hopefully, I'm not going to mince his name too much here because he did give us a really nice donation. Borgar Ebstus.
Yeah, and Paul Jones.
Andrew S. Baxter.
David Trundle.
Yeah, and he's from Black Label Empire.
All made very generous donations to the show. We really appreciate that, guys. Obviously, anything you donate to the podcast keeps the show going, pays for all our hosting and everything like that. And if you ever want to leave a little donation in our tip jar, you'll find that at theretrohour.com. Now, this week, a bit of a first, we've actually got a repeat guest.
So. Yeah. And it's not that we're running out of guests. No. It's that they're doing something new.
Now, this is Anthony and Nicola Caulfield, who were behind the Bedrooms to Billions movies. Obviously, we had the first one that was huge.
Yep. Amiga years followed that.
That was the last one, yeah. This time, they're going to be focusing on the PlayStation.
PlayStation Revolution.
Yeah, which
Looking
is currently...
forward to seeing it.
It's a Kickstarter at the moment, and they're going to be coming on. We're going to have... Of course, the PlayStation's a huge system, and to be fair, I think, you know, 41 episodes in... We haven't really covered it as much as we should.
It destroyed everything.
Well, you know what gets me about the PlayStation? Obviously, such a huge impact over in the UK. You don't actually see many British YouTubers, podcasters actually speaking about it that much. Like, you always see like how it did in America and how it did sales and the impact it said, but it did. But I think it would just be a really interesting watch just to see how it got on in the UK, just to see a different area.
Well, I remember when they launched it, the campaign, they had like Wipeout, that was a very European, UK-based thing. They didn't release that at the US on the launch.
Oh, did they not?
No. And they had in the nightclubs, when I used to go clubbing, they'd have PlayStations with Ridge Racer.
Oh, wow.
On them in like clubs in town. It was the time I'd ever seen a machine there, you know.
So a full-on PlayStation chat on the way in around 25, 30 minutes from now with Anthony Caulfield. Unfortunately, Nicola can't join us this week, but we will find out all about their new movie and their research they've done so far in just a bit on the Retro Hour. Now, let's get into this week's news stories. Now, first of all, you know, it's always quite interesting to find out people that had kind of lives before they were famous, as it were. Now, this is a guy that made Shazam, and apparently he invented something quite divisive, the internet toolbar.
Yeah, so he was saying it was 1998, the early days of the internet, and I was trying to figure out how to organise my bookmarks and passwords and usernames and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So he talked to a friend who's a software developer, and they kind of came up with this toolbar idea.
Now, this guy's called Rich Riley. Was he working for Yahoo at the time then?
I think he must have been.
Okay. Yeah. And he reckons he invented the internet toolbar.
You see, it says that, and I want to see solid evidence, because I feel like it's just one of those things where you see somebody like in the bar and something, and it's just like, oh, you ever see that film? Yeah, that film that came out last year. I came up with that idea 20 years ago. This article's not giving me any solid information that he actually invented the toolbar.
Well, it says he invented it in 1998. That seems pretty late, though, for me.
That's what I thought. That was my initial thought. I was like, oh, 1998, that's really late. But, you know, it's there on the article. And we all believe everything on the internet.
It's been all over the news this month. Mm-hmm. So it's been like, you know, on BBC and everything, Guardian. It's pretty mad.
But then, what do you think of toolbars? I don't like them.
No, they're all right. But, you know, this idea of inventing stuff, like my cousin made a browser back in the days that had tabs on it.
Right.
And so, you know, my cousin invented tab browsing, but that's probably not the case. But, you know, it's like hard to pin down who invented what at each time,
yeah,
especially
definitely.
With the net when it's so fast.
I find toolbars as well just kind of like what your mum uses on the internet when she doesn't really know what she's doing. And she's got about 8 installed anyway.
Yeah, by accident, yeah.
So they're all flashing at you and it's just like, what's this? This is my Google one. It's just like, all right, okay.
It's my Ask Jeeves one.
Yeah, exactly.
The browsing screen's down to like 50%. Yeah. The rest of it's just toolbars.
There is a great screenshot of that, isn't there, where it is literally like 75% of the browser is just like toolbars. So, well, there you go. Rich Riley, if you are to thank for toolbars, then, props, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, this is quite an interesting article in crack.com. This is 7 ways that retro games sucked that kids today wouldn't realise.
Okay.
Sucked is a strong word for me, because if retro games is, like, my passion, I adore retro games, I think and breathe retro games every day, but I do understand this list.
It's more the quirks that they had, I suppose, isn't
definitely.
It?
Yeah, definitely.
So the first one is bad translation was common and could royally screw you over. Now, this goes back to a lot of those games being made in Japan.
Yeah.
And it was before the days of, you know, you could just log on to, like, Google Translate and get, you know, pretty stuff like, you know, Welcome to Die and...
All your base belongs to us.
They're the famous one. A winner is you is another one here as well. Which, you know, looking back, though, it is kind of quaint, isn't it? It's part of the charm and fun of the games, though, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, the one that comes to my mind is Castlevania, an instruction manual. It's like the pork chop to heal yourself with, but it's a chicken leg, and it's just like, okay, like, whatever.
I guess as well, because, like, we focus a bit on European gaming, and Joe's more of a Sega Japan guy.
Yeah.
He's probably got more of the translator titles.
There's a few that come to mind straight away, like the original Zelda had a lot of issues with the instruction manual. Yeah. And funny enough, the next thing that sucked on the list is many games were unplayable without instruction manuals. Mm-hmm. So what comes to my mind is when you've got a badly translated game, what you need an instruction manual for to understand how to play the game, and then that instruction manual is badly translated as well.
But even the amount of guys that didn't bother reading the instruction manuals. So I had a guy the other day saying to me, oh, I can't get past this on Lemmings 2. And he'd been playing it for like 20 years. And I was like, oh, that's a little fan. It controls the wind. Yeah. And he was like, you've opened up the whole game for me.
You've opened a new dynamic. Yeah.
But I think the manual.
I think a lot of that is, though, as well, that, you know, I know it wasn't just me that did this. A lot of us had dodgy copies of games, so you didn't get a manual with it. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, my typical thing, like I say, like Ravi says, I'm the SNES and Sega generation, Mega Drive generation. My problem was with my mum throwing away the boxes for all the games, and often the manuals are in there. So, you know, people are probably screaming right now, oh my God, your mum's throwing away the stuff. But, you know, like I said before, mums don't know better when it comes to technology.
Just get this crap out of
here. Yeah.
And number 5 on the list is getting hints was a massive hassle. Now, it was. You had to wait for magazines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a bit easier in the mid to late 90s, early 2000s, because you obviously had, like, Games Master, and you'd get every couple of issues or so, you would get like the manuals, which would come with the cheat books. But half the time, those cheat books didn't work. Like, I remember all the cheats for Golden and I never, ever worked. Like, you had to just go through the game and unlock them. But they were like, oh, if you go to the menu and twist the N64 stick and all this kind of stuff. But they never bloody worked.
I think that was actually it when PlayStation Magazine came out. That was a big change for me as well, because they actually started having tons of cheat codes in there. And previously, it would be like scraps of paper or little notepads that you'd have it on. But now, you'd have it in a nice magazine.
Oh, I've got a real fond memory of being about 5 years old at school. And my older brother running over to me and saying to me, we were playing through Zombies Ate My Neighbours. So Zombies, it's known over here. And he came over to me, and the passwords were only 4 digits long on that game. And I had to remember the first 2 digits of the password, and he had to remember the second 2 digits of the password because a friend at school had told him how to get to like level 30.
All day, like forgetting all your lessons. Yeah. Don't talk about maths or algebra.
Oh my God. Number 7 and letter M.
But that's true. I mean, I remember getting like, you know, the Sonic the Hedgehog like cheat at school. Someone in the playground knew it, and everyone's like, we're going to try it out when we get back. And it was, you know, that's kind of how you did it a lot of the time.
Yeah,
you,
definitely.
You'd watch that like Games Master on TV, you know, when the, but even, put the
even,
helmet on.
Even magazines wouldn't publish them that much, you know. There wasn't like massive. If you wanted cheats, you'd have to get an actual replay or encode it all in or get one of these weird manuals.
Or pay like £2 to ring like a tip
premium
line or something.
Line.
Like in the film The Wizard, where they ring about Ninja Gaiden.
Well, the next one on the list, funnily enough, is if you wanted game cheats, you had to pay for them. And obviously, there's a picture of like a game genie here as well, which was the case. Moving on to the next page. Number 3, every single accessory was terrible and broken. Now, I don't think console accessories have ever really been a massive success, even like up to like the Kinect and stuff like that. It's not great.
Even up to like you say, the Xbox 360, the Kinect was crap.
So is the Xbox One Kinect.
Yeah, definitely. And then like, you know, like the fans, the cooldown fans and stuff that released for the 360, like they had so many issues with them actually overheating the Xbox.
Dance Revolution was really good.
Mm. Yeah,
and Guitar Hero. There were a few like...
There's a few, but they weren't that cheaply made. If you go back to the 80s and 90s, they were always third party cheap tat, really, weren't they?
Yeah, the unofficial ones. Yeah. Those were the,
yeah.
I was watching one of LGR's videos not long ago, and he's talking about, you know, like a system where you use mind control to play that game and stuff like that. There's some weird gimmicks back then. Number 2, which is actually, because a lot of people don't realise this, I don't think, games used to be a lot more expensive back in the day. And you think about it, I mean, I remember, like, in the early 90s, you would, like, you'd often pay, like, 60 quid sometimes for, like, a Super Nintendo game. And
Even I was doing some research on the PlayStation today, and the PlayStation was one of the first consoles to not come with a package game. So I remember when I first bought mine, it had Micro Machines, which was about 40 or 50 quid for the copy of that, and just a load of demo discs that I'd sit and play, and that's all I play because I couldn't afford the next game.
You see, I mean, I must have been quite spoilt because of Christmas 1995, we were asked what Sega Mega Drive games we want, and I'd pick Street Fighter 2. And as amazing as it was getting a PlayStation, I remember being a little bit disappointed that I didn't get Street Fighter 2. But we got a PlayStation, and we got 4 games with it as well. Oh, wow. So that must have cost my parents a bomb, actually, because we got Porsche Challenge, Hardcore 4x4, Soviet Strike, and Soul Blade. So we were very lucky, actually, to get 4 games with the PlayStation.
Yeah, I think that might have been later in their life as well, because I got it when
Christmas 96, actually.
$3.99, so it's ridiculous.
Well, looking at this chart here, they reckon if you took an average game price in 1992, they've done this in dollars, but it'd be $142 today, so pretty much like, you know, double the price,
Well,
you know, they say retro gaming's really expensive. Actually, it's just reaching the prices of the original games sometimes.
Well, this is the thing,
you know?
And it's like with the consoles as well, the actual hardware, like, you see these things and it's like, oh yeah, the 3DO was £300 when it first came out. But back then in the early 90s, if you look at inflation now, like Dan just said, that's actually like 900 quid now.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
If somebody said, oh yeah, the PS4 is 900 quid, people would go mad.
I think the 3DO was like 600 quid, actually.
Was it?
Yeah,
it's
so crazy. About 1,200 quid today, wouldn't
it? Yeah, it's mad.
And at number 1 on the list, early copy protection was totally insane. Code wheels. Check out page so-and-so in the manual and type it in.
Dongles.
I remember that. There was it RoboCop 3D on the Amiga? You actually had to plug a little like hardware dongle into the joystick port. And I remember all the magazines went like, this is going to be, you know, defeat piracy. It's the most advanced copy protection. It was crap the day it came out. So.
Didn't they say that about Monkey Island, though, when they the little
Code Wheel.
The Code Wheel came out, and they were like, oh, this is going to protect all these games. And all the kids at school just cut them out and copied them.
Mum's photocopier machine at work. So we'll pop the full list if you want to read these in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, thank you to Michael Wynn, who submitted this really cool bit of hardware for the Raspberry Pi. And this allows you to use modern printers with your retro systems.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. It seems to be like a little USB device. And you can basically use like your old systems like, you know, Amiga or Sinclair Spectrum or Amstrad and print on like really modern high-end PCs, which, you know, people don't make these drivers for these PCs anymore. They stopped at about the end of the dot matrix period. It's like, you know, HP aren't going to be interested in supporting the Spectrum.
What just makes me laugh is the fact that somebody's just gone to all this time and effort just for something so niche and obscure.
Well, it's like it uses a Raspberry Pi. That's how it works. So you network it with your PC, with your old machine. And apparently it's got like, you know, a Citronics printer port on there as well. But I think it works both ways. So it also means that you could hook up your, like, you know, your Core i7 PC to a 9-pin dot matrix as well.
That's it.
If you want to wake your neighbours up.
It looks like it just clips on top of the actual Raspberry Pi, and then you just can clip it at the back, and it's using the processing for the Raspberry Pi to do something.
It's by the GPIO port, by the looks of it, isn't it? So
Yeah,
that's pretty awesome, though. And if you ever wanted to, because you know, we're at play over the weekend. There was one of those thermal printers for the Sinclair Spectrum, and they actually worked on heat, and they were like a little till roll. But they were like £90 they were selling them for at this store there. And I was like, a bit of novelty, but hook it up to your laser printer now if you want to, can't you?
Totally. Your old program. Or if you want to have a dot matrix office.
It could be the pie trick when you have all the nerds over. Look what I can do.
This is pretty cool. A very rare Nintendo arcade machine called Monkey Magic has finally surfaced. Now, have you guys ever heard of this?
No, I'm just reading it now. I've never heard of it at all. So
I played Monkey Ball, but
a little bit before that.
How'd you lose an arcade machine, like a arcade board or whatever? That's what gets me. So
what's weird about it is it was made in 1979.
Okay,
in very, very small numbers, apparently. They only put out a few, and it was only in Japan. So it was really, you know, obscure machine. It was essentially a clone of Breakout. By the looks of it, but if you, I mean, there is actually a video here of someone playing it. And it was released on MAME a couple of years ago. And I think at the time, everyone was kind of like, well, where did this ROM dump come from? Because no one's got the machine anywhere. And then, you know, there's a video released on YouTube showing it working and everything, but no one knew where that came from. And there was a picture that was released 20 years ago, and it shows a Monkey Magic arcade cabinet in an arcade. And again, it was somewhere in Japan. Collectors all over the world have been trying to find it. And then really randomly, earlier this week, one popped up on Yahoo Auctions.
That's brilliant.
Kind of like Japan's equivalent of eBay.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not sure how much it's going for at the time of this, but I imagine it's going to be a fair bit, being a one-of-a-kind Nintendo arcade machine.
Yeah, definitely.
And it looks really kind of, really old-school build. You know, just wooden strapped to the side, the PCB board.
That flat screen still, like, looking down at the screen rather than it facing you. Kind of
no RF shielding and, like, a multi-tap plug thing there. It just looks domestic. It's like, you know.
But it's, you know, you look at this 1979, and it was really before, you know, the big arcade revolution. It was right at the start of it, really. Nintendo have been around for like over like 100 years or so, haven't they? They've done like, you know, a lot of stuff. I mean, I was even seeing the other day there was a World War II Nintendo board game was on eBay as well. You know, featuring Disney characters really randomly, so
it's quite weird. I mean, it does look like a really nice build, just a nice looking arcade cabinet, and the graphics as well for 79 just look really nice and bright and vibrant, but it's kind of what you expect from Nintendo, I guess.
Well, Nintendo Leisure Systems as well, according to the back of it.
From what I've read about it as well, I've not played it on MAME, but, you know, I intend to after I've read this. But a lot of people say it's even better than Breakout. It's one of those rare examples of a clone actually being better than the original game. So that old Nintendo quality was there even then, apparently. Speaking of Nintendo as well, actually, there's quite an interesting little bit on Reddit's retro gaming discussion here. It's really talking about the price of retro gaming systems and games actually trending down now and actually becoming a bit cheaper. I mean, they're actually talking specifically about the NES. But I wondered, you know, some people in the comments are saying they've kind of seen this across the board.
I think depending on what's kind of hot at the moment, so like last year when Majora's Mask was re-released, just prior to the re-release, the game just skyrocketed on eBay, like £100 of box copies. And then you kind of genuinely, you know, yesterday when we were at play, I was seeing copies of it for like £55 and stuff, which is kind of like the general eBay kind of price now. So I think it all depends on what's hot at the moment. And I mean, you've obviously, we've got the mini Nintendo coming out, but yeah, generally I tend to find that they're just getting more and more expensive.
I think the world's getting poorer and the games are getting more expensive. So that's...
Well, I think, you know, when you mentioned then you can often get stuff cheaper, you know, find it then they sell for a lot more. You had an example recently with a CD32 game.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, what was this, the one that I bought a few years ago?
Yeah, well, 15 quid you paid, didn't you?
Yeah, I paid 15,
what
20
was it?
Quid. Black Viper for the Amiga, and that was from Amiga Kit. Matt had kind of left it out there. I stupidly ripped the seal off just to play it like an idiot. But there was a listed one with unripped seal for 800 quid that just sold on eBay.
No way.
And that's in 2 years, which is just insane in inflation.
That's crazy. I mean, I don't know. Like, I bought Castlevania for the Mega Drive, New Generations / Bloodlines, depending where you're from. And I got that for $4.99 from a secondhand shop about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And now that's like a £150 game. So I don't know, I just genuinely see it always just going up, to be honest.
Well, like, I kind of had this whole thing last week where I was like, oh, these games are getting so much, I'm going to sell it all and buy
a car. You nearly did, didn't you? You nearly did.
Yeah. Like, you know, but then I figure, who cares in the end? You know, I've always wanted this collection, so I'm going to just build it. And if it all declines in value, I'll still be happy.
You see, it's always been my dream to have, like, a big, nice big games room with everything all set up. And now I've actually bought my house with my missus and everything, I have that. And then part of me was like, oh, I could sell all this and get, you know, get a nice big fancy wedding and a really nice honeymoon next year. And then I was kind of like, well, no, because it's always been my dream to have this big room of
games. She's going to get you
games
to sell it now, mate.
Yeah. Oh, no, she started counting my SNES games, my Super Nintendo collection, like adding them up as we're moving house.
What have you done, Joe?
No, I didn't sell them, but she said she felt sick and had to stop counting them up because she only got about 12 games in and got to over £1,000. And was just like, but if, to be fair, she started with like Secret of Mana and like Chrono Trigger and stuff, so
get a good lock on that door.
Yeah. She was like, I feel sick at how much these are worth and put them away.
So we'd love to know your thoughts. Maybe you've got a really good bargain, you know, if you found a game that sells for like hundreds of thousands and you got it for like £2 off a car boot sale, do let us know. Now, the Amstrad CPC is a system we've talked about a bit actually recently. It's had a bit of a resurgence, you could say, really. You know, recently there's been some new bits coming out on it.
Yeah, we're kind of exploring the Amstrad because we didn't know that much about it, so...
Yeah, I've only ever played, like, you know, my friend Graham's when I was a kid, but...
Yeah, I had an Amstrad PC clone, but that was just like a PC clone, so...
Well, someone's actually ported the Wolfenstein 3D engine to it, which is pretty cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's obviously 1992 it came out, id Software. And there's a team here called Optimus who have done it, and I think it's just a little demo at the moment, but it looks pretty cool. There's two different versions depending on how much RAM you've got, but it runs on like 64K.
They can't do floors and ceilings, can they? It's just the walls at the moment. But yeah, that's still amazing that they could get that atmosphere of a maze crawler, you know.
Well, it says here there's even doing a version for the GX4000 as well. Wasn't that the like the Amstrad console thing? Yeah, the white thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, which I think is just like a CPC in a console box. But I think it's impressive when people do that.
Yeah, I kind of like these old school remakes, demakes.
Demakes, as you call them, don't you?
Yeah.
So if you want to find out more about that, we'll shove that in this week's show notes as well. Now, China has banned gaming at night.
Yeah, so...
I know.
If you don't know, China has a massive problem and they actually have internet addiction centres. And if you watch a documentary that the BBC did, it's pretty horrific because, you know, some parents are like blaming this internet addiction on every social problem that their kid has. And people are escaping from there and going to play StarCraft at night, throughout night, you know, kind of...
Internet cafes.
And even to the point that these cafes have little pods that you can go and sleep in and play now. So the Chinese government has decided we're going to have children in China banned from playing computer games between the hours of midnight and 8 a.m.
You know what? When you first, like, sent me the link to it and everything, I thought, oh, what a ridiculous idea. But, you know, after Ravi just kind of gave a little bit more insight on it there, kind of seems quite sensible. I don't know if that's just me getting old, but... Yeah,
well, it's like
I get it.
It's kind of like fat camps or something that they have in America. It's like really harsh, and the parents are sending their kids to them, you know. And
yeah.
thinking this will solve everything. They were doing like electrodes on their heads and stuff.
Oh, I don't believe in that.
To try and solve it. You know?
I understand banning it at night, like especially if it's like a school night kind
of thing. Well, that's the thing. They're saying a lot of these kids are going out and then staying in these cyber cafes, doing all of this stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. It's kind of reminiscent of in Japan. Apparently it's like one of these like laws, but it's never really been disclosed. But like a Final Fantasy game and a Dragon Warrior game, Dragon Quest game, aren't allowed to be released on a weekday because of whenever they used to get released in the 90s, productivity in Japan just dipped.
Everyone has a sick day, yeah?
Yeah, everybody had a sick day. So now it's like, you know, it's an urban legend that's against the law that for them to come out in a weekday.
And StarCraft is the main... Yeah. You know, the main thing in Japan is massive.
Well, I was looking at how, you know, I was thinking how they're going to police this then. Apparently, they're going to require anyone under the age of 18 to register to play online using their official government ID papers.
Oh, wow.
So, and then gaming companies would use information to block access for those under 18 from midnight to 8 a.m. each day. So, I guess, you know, if you've got internet at home, it's probably going to be easier, but it's, yeah, I don't know, it's a bit odd. What are they class
proxy
as internet?
Proxy servers.
What are they class as internet addiction, though? That's what I want to know. It's like.
Yeah, no, that's the weird part about it, because, you know, some parents could come in and be like, my son's an internet addict and he's kind of like, you know, healthy and just going online a bit.
Yeah.
And then they could have some kid that's not eating because he's played so much. And,
I an internet addict because I use the internet all day at work? You
we're probably defined as internet addicts.
I buy 18 hours a day.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
so, yeah, it's a weird, really hard subject, internet addiction.
Absolutely. So quite. I mean, it's obviously a very different culture from over here. So.
Yeah, I think it's a feverish culture with gaming.
Yeah. Interesting. We'll keep an eye on that story. Now, we had to get a Tomb Raider story in for you this week, Ravi, didn't we? Oh, after you met Lara at the weekend. Yeah,
it's the 20th anniversary as well, Dan.
By the way, guys, did you hear that Ravi met Lara Croft?
Did you?
Yeah.
Haven't heard for 5 minutes.
Did you realise, guys, that Tomb Raider came out 20 years ago this year, lads?
We will just say... Oh. It was actually the Lara Croft you met, wasn't it? The original lady was a model for it.
Yeah.
Not just someone in cosplay.
Oh, did you know, lads, that it also came out on Sega Saturn? Yeah, we did, Ravi.
And you got it signed.
I got it signed, yeah. So, Lara Croft was the new Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
Actually written by Rihanna Pratchett, and she's the daughter of Terry Pratchett.
The author, yeah.
The Discworld author and famous... Very famous author. And
I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, and she said she wanted to make him, make Lara more human. So before, you know, she's just been boobs and kind of a sex figure for a long time. Not in the original games, but kind of after the third or the fourth or the fifth. Storyline took a backseat. So she's said, you know, the market sexualized her and turned it for the boys, pretty much.
Yeah.
And now she's kind of turned it back into a strong female character.
I think she was quite successful with that because of she had a lot of depth to her in the, you know, in Tomb Raider and Rise of the Tomb Raider. She wasn't, like you say, she wasn't just a big pair of tits running around on screen.
That's the best thing about those games, though. Yeah. It's the storyline and the kind of the connection that you get with the character. Like in the other ones, you were just playing this person, you know.
Yeah. A little bit like Duke Nukem.
Yeah, exactly.
You were just somebody.
I know you've been really into the latest Tomb Raider, haven't you, on the PC?
Yeah, because it's just so well optimised. If you're going to play any game on the PC, play that, because there's stuff like Assassin's Creed that is really badly done and really glitchy. But Tomb Raider, oh my God, it's like 4K, you can play it and it's beautiful.
Well, you obviously picked up the... version on the Sega Saturn over the weekend. Yeah. Have you played it yet?
I had a play on that last night.
What did you think?
It was all right, yeah. I just forgot how little you can do in Tomb Raider 1. So there's none of that box pushing stuff that you remember you did in the later stuff. The only bit I got to was you're shooting a dinosaur.
Oh, that's scary.
Remember that when it comes out. Yeah.
Yeah.
With the two pistols.
I find most memories of when you talk to people about Tomb Raider and they start listing off memories is they're always on about number 2 and 3. Number one didn't seem to get, especially with my kind of friends and stuff, like, you don't really hear many people going on about number 1. It was more number 2.
But also that design of the dinosaur and the T-Rex in there, that looked like the demo that they had on the PlayStation. You know that T-Rex one, yeah.
Yeah. So,
and Turok as well, which was a massive... It reminded me of Turok.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How did it compare to the PlayStation? Because I've never played the Saturn Tomb Raider.
Little tiny bits, but it's a bit less jaggy on the PlayStation.
Oh, really?
That's it. Mm. Like,
oh, okay.
Yeah, but I think it was because it was developed first.
I think it was ported to the Saturn from the PlayStation.
Yeah.
I think it was Saturn first and PlayStation after, it was.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, was it?
Originally, it was a Saturn exclusive, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because okay. Tony Gudd, who's the guy that designed it, was like Sega fanboy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like proper. And he was like, I'm going to design this for Sega. So he must have been so disappointed when the Saturn flopped.
Well, this would be a good time to lead into this week's interview, wouldn't it? Now that we're on the topic of PlayStation. So thank you for checking out episode number 41 of the Retro Hour podcast. We'll be out again next Friday on the website, theretrohour.com, iTunes, SoundCloud, YouTube, all of your favourite services. Should we get really nerdy about the PlayStation now?
Oh, totally.
Let's do it.
The movie's called From Bedrooms to Billions, The PlayStation Revolution, and the guy behind it, Anthony Caulfield, on the Retro Hour for the next 40 minutes. We'll catch you next week.
Ciao.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for this week's special guest from Bedrooms to Billions fame, and actually the first guest who we've had on the podcast twice. Thank you for coming back on, Anthony Caulfield.
Oh, wow. That's quite an honour.
Now, last time we talked to you, obviously, you were still working on the Bedrooms to Billions, the Amiga years. Just to quickly touch on that then, how did that all go then? We enjoyed it.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Funny enough, I'm actually still working on it. We're doing a... Well, when I say working on it, we're literally just we're finishing the mastering of the DVDs and Blu-rays. So there's huge toing and froing between the authoring house in Soho and us, just encoding stuff. I don't think it's quite funny actually. I don't think Amiga game footage anyone's ever really attempted to put it on a Blu-ray before. So it's you're taking something which is supposed to be one particular size. And then it's being stretched upwards, obviously, to 1080p. So there's lots of interesting discussions and hands on hips about codecs and compression ratios and lots of boring stuff like that. But the upshot is to try and make it look as good as it possibly can. So that's what we've been doing. But yeah, the film is it feels like it's never left me actually. But it's technically we actually delivered it back in May digitally. Mm-hmm. But we've got about. I mean, you're the first to know this, actually. So I don't want angry Kickstarter backers. They think they're getting 3 hours, but they're getting 3.5 hours.
Oh, I'm sure they won't complain.
Yeah, I can think of other things to complain about. But yeah, we've literally stretched the Blu-ray and DVD capacity to the absolute limit on the bonus disc, and managed to squeeze in a very long Team 17. Piece that we've been working on, which is very long.
Wow.
So we didn't want to cut it down. So we've been able to give a really, really long dedication. We're not on very PlayStation at the moment, are we? But very, very Amiga. My brain for the last 2 days has been completely Amiga.
So you've got an Amiga headache.
An Amiga hangover. Well, you haven't had any rest recently. I mean, you did kind of touch on the PlayStation because you are making yet another movie, Bedrooms to Billions, The PlayStation Revolution.
Yeah, it's going to be the last one. Because the thing is about these films is they roll into... by the way, I should sound excited about it. I don't mean to sound so mechanical. But it's basically, it seems to be that when we made, just rolling back very slightly, I promise we'll get very PlayStation in a second. When we finished when we were right near the end of editing From Bedrooms to Billions, the first movie, we knew, as the backers knew, but we knew that we were massively stepping over 16-bit. And the predominantly, obviously, the Amiga and ST era, and we felt that even though, funny enough, when you look at the running time, it's in the original movie, there's 18 minutes dedicated to the 16-bit era, it still looks like we've stepped over it. So we made all these notes from all the interviews that we did, we had all these things that we wanted to talk about, the Amiga and the 16-bit era, that we knew we wouldn't be able to squeeze into the movie unless we were planning to sort of make Ben-Hur 2, you know, sort of six-hour epic. So we thought, okay, well, we're going to have to do a film dedicated to the Amiga. That's the natural sort of moving on point from this. So we rolled straight into the Amiga years from Bedrooms. So it had no break. It was almost a continuous movement. And that's pretty much what's happened with the PlayStation Revolution, because when you're interviewing people over and over again, you get certain common phrases that come up over and over again. So no feeding from us, just literally... Blah, 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 and then the PlayStation changed everything. Blah, 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 and the PlayStation changed. And you just keep hearing PlayStation, PlayStation. So even though we thought we considered the PlayStation to be significant. When you're interviewing the developers, certainly the ones that grew up, certainly the ones that went right through the industry from the 70s, 80s and all the way through, and of course the what we would call the second and third generation developers that came in the 16-bit era and then slightly after, it's the same thing. The PlayStation seemed to change everything. And that doesn't mean that other consoles weren't significant. We're not suggesting that if we don't cover a console in our films that they're just not worth mentioning. That's not the case at all. But what we found is there's certain turning points in this 45 years now, the games industry, in this history. There's certain major branching off or turning points where something significant seemed to happen. And all the interviews we were doing for obviously the first film and then the Amiga years, the PlayStation was continually coming up, just like the Amiga was continually coming up when we were doing the first movie. So it just felt like if we're going to tell this story properly, we need to look at why that PlayStation was so significant. And perhaps it will get us to a point where when we get to the end of the PlayStation revolution, you know, we'll be sort of tying a bow around it and saying, okay, well, this is our take on at least this part of the games industry. I genuinely don't know because we've only just started shooting. We've literally just been getting everything together. We've just had to take a little bit of a hiatus just to finish the mastering of the Amiga years, and Nicola's been working very, very hard finishing off all the editing for the special features while I've been prepping for the PlayStation revolution.
Well, you say that lots of people mention the PlayStation. We've interviewed so many developers on this show and they've talked about the first time they saw that PlayStation demo unit and the, you know, G-Rex, the giant Tyrannosaurus Rex, and how significant it was and such a change in the industry. Was it kind of a hard decision for Sony, and how did the whole kind of PlayStation begin?
It's very interesting you interviewing them at this point, because I'd be dying to know how I would answer that question in 6 months' time, because by that point we would have interviewed, you know, the main hardware team, because, you know, Nicola and I would like to speak to the people themselves, and Sony have been fantastic in sort of helping us secure those interviews. So we're going to be hearing directly from the people themselves that created the PlayStation, and there were some Brits involved and some others. But what we're going to try and understand, I'm answering this question as open as possible, because obviously anybody can open up Wikipedia and read what they think is their take on how the PlayStation came about. Nicola and I really want to find out what happened. But this legendary fallout between Sony and Nintendo, how did that come about? Why did it collapse? Is it true that Sony then went full tilt into making a 3D console purely to get back at Nintendo? Our early research has shown actually that's more real than it's actually more absolutely fact, but we'll find out when we start interviewing people, and hopefully we'll hear from some Nintendo people as well. But there seemed to be a reluctance from Sony initially to really make it do the project, because at that point, if you really think about it, there wasn't a brilliant history in non-games companies having a successful games console. It tended to sort of go, I'm thinking about Apple and the Pippin and all sorts of nightmares that seem to exist. So Sony were one of those positions where they had no experience of games.
Also CD-based systems as well. There was a lot of CD-based systems like 3DO and CDI that all kind of weren't very successful.
The key was actually how to get the data, how to really make use of the disc. So you've got storage capacity, which is fantastic, obviously. You're going, you know, when you compare it to a cartridge or a floppy disk. A CD is just literally like Utopia, isn't it? It's just such a huge, huge jump up. But the key was how quickly to get the data from the disk so that it could actually make a difference in the game. And, you know, when you look at some of the other CD-based systems where the data, the actual being able to make the data come into the game real time was a real issue. And that seemed to be one of the big things that the PlayStation, they were trying to solve. In those early days, in trying to make it so that, okay, we can really truly make use of CD. This is, forget 3D for a moment, how to truly make use of the CD, how to actually make it so that it wasn't just a storage system for music or the game itself, it was actually able to stream stuff in and bring stuff in real time, or certainly a lot faster. I mean, compared with today's speeds, it was, you know, incredibly slow, but still, then you take in the whole 3D environment. What then happened was when these demos that you mentioned earlier on in the program suddenly were shown, developers immediately started all those games that they'd, those ideas that they'd shelved away all those years earlier and marked up as impossible, at least impossible at that point. They started to open those drawers in their brain and go, hang on a minute, I could do that now, and I could do that. And game developers, when they're working at their best, when they see new technology, those ideas that they've tucked away, they then can bring them out. And that's why you then see that flurry of early games where suddenly Martin Edmondson, for example, able to do a game like Driver. When he was a kid, he was a fan of all of those 70s cop movies, Bullet and 69, but you know what I mean. Yeah. All those sort of cop movies and everything, and just think, right, that's the type of game I've always wanted to make, and now with 3D I can actually do it. If you also look at people like Phil Harrison, literally walking around, working for Sony, Sony had no reputation as a games, certainly as a games developer or publisher or anything. He's walking around with a suitcase, going around all the development studios in Europe, trying to convince people, say, look, this really is going to be a game changer, and trying to convince developers to actually risk their livelihood, really, on a new system from an untested company. I mean, it was Sony, so it's not as if it's some sort of, you know, they have got a bit of money, so you could probably guarantee that they were going to do it. But still, developers to then take 6 months or a year of their life when they're trying to develop, when they're used to things like SNES and the Mega Drive, to take a leap of faith, it really did make a big difference.
We had the Oliver Twins on our show not long ago, and they were talking about how they got one of the early PSM development kits, and apparently a lot of their contemporaries at the time and developers all had massive doubts that the PlayStation would be a success at all. I mean, is that kind of something you ran into, or did a lot of people kind of say that to you?
Funny enough, we're going to be interviewing the Olivers. Mm-hmm. We haven't done it yet, but they've actually said that. I've already exchanged emails with them, and they've said that. Bearing in mind the people we've interviewed for the earlier two movies, there was a large portion of them had great success with the PlayStation. So obviously, I've not encountered people yet that said that they had issues with the PlayStation. However, one thing I did encounter on the first film, which I actually asked Phil Harrison about, funny enough, because Phil Harrison was one of the last interviews we did from Bedrooms to Billions, was some developers are saying they found they couldn't get on the Sony bandwagon because they couldn't afford the development kits. And they were sort of quoting various prices, which were way out of, you know, sort of many, many thousands. So when one company in particular was Denton Designs. If you remember Denton Designs, yeah. Big success in the 8-bit era and a little bit on the 16-bit. But they wanted to make that jump to PlayStation, and they felt they couldn't. And a few other developers told me the same thing, because they just couldn't afford the development kit. So when I asked Phil Harrison about that, he said, well, we tried to make them as cheap as possible. It wasn't like we were trying to, you know, cut people out of the market, but they were extremely expensive pieces of kit, at least the early systems, because they did scale them. They did scale them down eventually and come up with those blue ones and a few other ones to make them a bit easier. There were a lot of developers that were able to sort of make that leap. And I think the 3D was the door for them, was the gateway to actually start producing whole different types of games.
Well, I think, you know, originally when the PlayStation was kind of spoken about and you saw it in the magazines and stuff like that, everyone assumed, because the 3DO would come out and that was like $700. Everyone thought the PlayStation was going to be a fortune. Then there was obviously that infamous moment with Steve Race where he came up on stage and he just said those words, 299.
I asked Phil about that, and effectively it was almost at a loss. They were, you know, it was because they knew that if they didn't make it so that it was, you know, you'd have to be nuts to not buy it. You know, it's such an amazing piece of kit, so cheap. And they knew that people would take a punt on it, because it was exactly that. If it was £800, which you could argue, comparing it to other consoles that were sort of in that similar ilk, or certainly before, certainly we take things like the Neo Geo and things, you know, you've got that sort of bracket of, you could say, oh, maybe it is £800, £700 or £800 would be justifiable for a 3D CD-based console of that power. So, yeah, it's quite astonishing. I want to understand exactly how they were able to make it quite so cheap. But maybe it's just simply because Sony obviously had that incredible manufacturing track record. And obviously, if anybody was in a position to get component prices and other elements as cheap as possible, then it would be Sony. So we obviously want to understand that, because that price point was critical in getting those consoles out across the world. and decent marketing. And also the other thing, which is absolutely critical whenever you're launching anything, is a good batch of early titles to really catch the eye. When you take games like Ridge Racer, and, you know, we've heard from Namco already, in the fact that they were able to take their existing arcade machine, their arcade titles at the time, Ridge Racer being one of them, and effectively, with a little bit of scaling down, not a great deal, but technically taking the same game and getting it to run, so people were able to see what they were familiar with arcade, true arcade games running in the home, that again made a big difference.
When I first saw a PlayStation, it was actually in a nightclub, and they had a row of Ridge Racer machines, and they were all free to play. And this was one of the first time that I'd seen, I consider normal people, non-geeks, sitting down and playing on this and enjoying it. Yeah, the cool kids are actually going and playing on these machines, and that was a drastic change from before.
Yeah, we've heard that with Wipeout was another one that was obviously very popular, popular in clubs. And, you know, that was a really, really big deal. And that's the thing. It made it, you know, people banned the word around making it cool and other things, but it did make gaming mainstream and cool. Gaming was obviously very popular before the PlayStation, and it was continuing to grow. But the PlayStation came along at that incredible time with the right console, 3D, with us and CD. You know, it had a company behind it that could cash flow it in such a way to really get it out across the world with the advertising and all sorts of other things.
Wipeout for me as well was such a big title when it came out, and it massive in Europe, you know, and this was also because the graphics kind of hark back to those demo scene days where you had tunnels and, yeah, you know, all these old kind of effects, and it all just seemed to come together with a banging soundtrack. It was just amazing.
I think that's a really, really good point. Wipeout seems to be a game that people mention a lot because it's one of them jaw-droppers, isn't it? You know, when as we talked about with the Amiga years, Defender of the Crown was one of those early titles, or Marvel Madness, where people went, oh my God, because they were used to seeing computer games looking like old-fashioned computer games, and suddenly you had an arcade game and a very, very good-looking home game suddenly appearing on this new computer, the Amiga, and people going, wow, and getting a full feel of it. Roll ahead 10 years and Wipeout, Ridge Racer, and some of those early games were a major factor. For me, actually, it was actually Resident Evil. Mm-hmm. Resident Evil was one of the... I had a PC, funny enough, but my cousin had a PlayStation, and he just happened to get Resident Evil for it. And that was the first game I really properly played on the PlayStation. I think the other thing I'm very interested in understanding from developers, certainly at the very beginning of the PlayStation, is also how they were able to get the 3D working. Because obviously you're going from a two-dimensional programming mindset to a three-dimensional mindset, and the mathematics that are involved to make that happen. I mean, funny enough, developers are going through that now with all the augmented reality and virtual reality and the other things. They're having to suddenly think again.
A lot of those early PlayStation titles were kind of, you know, newer versions of games that we saw on other, you know, platforms like the Amiga, for example. Like we had, 3D Lemmings, I remember, came out on there as well.
Jungle Strike and Desert Strike, they had a few of those.
Not all of them kind of worked, but it did seem like everything had to be 3D all of a sudden, and it didn't always translate that well, did it?
No, it didn't. You get that, because obviously you get a couple of very successful 3D titles and everybody latches on, we've got to do 3D. And then you get an obsession with this new style that everybody then wants to emulate and go for. And then it gets to a point where it gets boring. Then you suddenly see a renaissance in different styles again, and 2D has another little comeback. And you do tend to get that. That's not a new thing at all. I think one of the other things as well is that we did cover this on the first film, but the PlayStation also saw a real increase in actual less risk-averse ideals. And what I mean by that is a developer could then start, because of the way that the games were manufactured on CD, they were so much cheaper to actually make, to actually manufacture. And I think for anyone that's seen the first From Bedrooms to Billions film, we cover the fact of how cartridge manufacturing and publishing was a nightmare, because obviously you had your game, which, let's say for the sake of argument, was in development for a year, and then the publisher had to guess, basically, because it took 3 to 4 months to make the cartridges, they had to be ordered and paid for up front. So this is obviously for the SNES and the Mega Drive I'm talking about, but So you had to sort of gamble, you know, 3-4 months ahead. And if you got it wrong, and you had, say, a Jurassic Park on your hands that's sort of flying off the shelves, and you've underordered your stock, a game that you might have spent X million on developing, suddenly you've blown it because the game takes off, you haven't got enough stock. But on the flip side, if you think this is going to be a surefire hit and order millions of cartridges and the game tanks, you've got millions of, you know, hundreds of thousands of cartridges sitting in a warehouse earning you nothing. So with the PlayStation, because the manufacturing, you know, you could order a low amount just because you might not be 100% sure if this game's going to be a winner. You order a lower amount, and then if you order more, it takes 3-5 days to order a new set of stock, but not 4 months.
That's great.
So you could spend more on an experimental title or something a little bit more risky or whatever. Or certainly you could concentrate your funding on the development to make a really, really good game without being so paranoid about the stock at the end of it, how many you were going to produce. It just created a little bit more freedom for developers.
I guess that's why games like Prapper the Rapper came out that were, you know, total different concepts than we'd had before.
I still remember the first time I saw it. I mean, it's almost taking the mickey out of 3D, isn't it? This sort of 2D paper. But isn't it an original game? Isn't it just an amazing, fun little game? I still remember when I first saw that.
And I think also around the time that the PlayStation came out, the advertising was a big part of it as well because, you know, what we mentioned kind of earlier, it made gaming grown up. You know, the Super Nintendo and the Mega Drive were like seen as a bit kiddie after the PlayStation came out. And their advertising was quite edgy. I mean, from what you've heard, Sega's was kind of pretty similar a couple of years before, trying to appeal to that kind of teenage demographic maybe. Do you think they ever took any pages out of Sega's book for that to aim for like the cooler audience?
I don't know, actually. I mean, I had the privilege of interviewing Tom Kalinske once. Mm-hmm. We did a... you find it on YouTube, actually. We did a Sonic... We were asked to make a 25th anniversary or 20th anniversary. I think it's 20 or 25th anniversary. Should know, of course. Documentary on Sonic the Hedgehog. So we covered all that. We did a... it was a 70-minute film or 50-minute film that was broadcast all over the place. And we interviewed Tom Kalinske and we asked him specifically about that advertising. And he just felt that though we might get sued, Nintendo was streets ahead of them, so we've got to find any way that we can to claw that back. So they just pulled the gloves off. So I think with Sony, certainly that trend is starting to move that way. I mean, Commodore did it a couple of times. They did it with the CD32, famously, mm-hmm. With their poster outside of Sega's offices. To be this good will take Sega ages, you know, because it was starting to move towards that thing. But I think the advertising with the PlayStation, I think it was about 100 notches higher. They're not just edgy, they're way out. They're way, way, way out there. And I think that's what Sony were trying to do. They were trying to make this console is truly different, edgy, dark, not so much dark, but, you know, just different and not kiddified. And I don't think you can make it any less. You can't move it further away from your kiddies.
Well, I always remember the one with the girl with the pigtails in, you know, with the Scottish accent. Yeah. I was like, you saw that on TV, like, what's this about?
It's like Channel 4 late at night, you know, when they used to play really weird stuff. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. And that was all around the PS2 era. It just cranked from about 2000. I used to watch, I seem to remember the Champions League. PlayStation seemed to stick a load of PS2 ads on. Around the Champions League on ITV in the early noughties, as everyone calls it now, and you'd see these, you know, the Man U would be losing or winning or whatever, and it goes to half time, and then you suddenly just get this bizarre advert, you know, with directed by Lynch or somebody else. So we want to explore that because again, that all helped move the games industry forward. Suddenly you were seeing nowadays you do get adverts for game commercials on mainstream television that you think, whoa, you know, they're a little bit... Well, actually, I have to say, without, again, trying to sound like a granddad here, but I have to say, I think gaming commercials seem to have lost their edge a little bit in the last couple of years, or last year or so. I haven't seen anything that's really sort of made me sit up, and they all seem to be sort of very, very... a bit like movie trailers, the way they've sort of all... movie trailers seem to have sort of over in 15 seconds, and it's just a sort of blur of imagery.
Yeah, Old Spice trailers are now like games commercials used to be.
That's very true, isn't it?
Brilliant, I love that.
Well, one thing that I found was when I bought a PlayStation first, it didn't actually come with a game. You know, you had to buy one separately, but it came with all these demo discs. So I'd kind of survive on these demo discs. And Net Euros was like a little development unit where people could do it at home. And I'd often get the games in the magazines. I really love that kind of little independent development scene they had going.
We're going to cover that. We're going to cover it because it's... and I'm also interested to know... Sorry, I do apologise. It is Nicola and I. She's not here at the moment, but I'm speaking for myself. But we are very interested to know how many developers have gone on into mainstream game development now because of that development system. I know of a few, but I think there's no way of getting away from it. It was certainly an extremely interesting and original thing to do because the whole concept of, you know, with, and I'm not in any way trying to disrespect Nintendo or Sega, but when you weigh up, that there was no, there just couldn't be any sort of system like that on those consoles. It was, and you also have to look at it and think, why did Sony do that? Obviously, it was a positive thing, but I don't hear people really talking about that step that they took, you know, to create a development system that would allow people to sort of get into console development. I appreciate it wasn't a full-blown development system, but it was pretty damn good. And it opened the door for people to give them that sort of interest. I mean, nowadays, so many people seem to be desperate to get into game design. And there's all sorts of things available for them and everything else. But a console developer suddenly offering something like that, it was very, very original and interesting step. So we definitely want to cover that.
Well, Ravi mentioned then quite an interesting point, that, you know, about the lack of packing games and stuff as well. Obviously, I mean, you know, Sega had Sonic and Nintendo had Mario. Was there ever any kind of thought of that PlayStation might need a mascot in its early days?
From what we've heard is that they felt that Lara Croft could be that mascot, you know, Crash was sort of a mascot. I mean, some PlayStation fans regard Crash as a mascot, but I think a sort of an unofficial mascot was probably, certainly in the early days, would be Lara Croft, because I mean, don't forget that game wasn't actually, the original Tomb Raider wasn't created for the PlayStation.
It was a Saturn, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was created for the Saturn, but Sony just knew it. They were on it immediately. And there's a funny story about, you might know that, you probably know Ian Livingstone's story about how he discovered Tomb Raider. For those of you who have seen From Bedrooms to Billions, Jeff Brown, who was the founder of US Gold, you know, very successful publisher and Centresoft distributor during the 1980s, he went out to America and bought a lot of Epic's titles and other amazing American games and made them available across Europe through his US Gold brand. US Gold went on to release games like in Europe, such as Flashback and Another World and some really, really amazing titles. But by the mid-90s, they got into trouble, financial trouble, very much because of the console, the cartridge system, actually, we were talking about earlier, pretty much spelled their demise. But one of the last things that US Gold did was they bought Core, and Core were designing several games at the time, and when US Gold finally were about to go under, they sold out to Eidos. Ian Livingstone and some of the other guys at Eidos took turns to drive around to look at the various properties and other things that they owned, and Ian Livingstone drew the straw to go to Derby to see Core, and he said he was in a dreadful mood. You know, it's raining, like Tuesday afternoon, just want to get home. So, he was even trying to put off going in to see Core. This sounds obviously incredibly disrespectful, but he does tell it in a funny way. And it's an outtake, so one day it will see the light of day because we've filmed it. And he went in there and he saw one room where there was this very nondescript shoot 'em up in one room. And he went in another room, met a guy called Toby. He said, oh, this is a game I'm working on for the Saturn called, I think he, at that time it was called Tomb Raider. But he just said he saw it and his jaw dropped. And he was on the phone and ringing back to the Eidos guys and saying, I've just seen this absolutely amazing game. But within the space of about a year or so, Sony basically made them an offer to say, we want to take that exclusively to PlayStation. To answer your question about mascots, I think Lara Croft had a massive impact.
Well, I think as well, because of, you know, we kind of mentioned, you know, it was very heavily that teenage boy demographic. Lara Croft was probably the perfect kind of mascot for it, really, I suppose, wasn't she?
Yeah, there you go. You see, that's the... I can still remember the life-size models outside of various shops and, you know, W.H. Smith and other places sort of seeing her. Tomb Raider 2, of course, was, I think, the one that really stamped it. And that's another thing, by the way. Tomb Raider, as we mentioned, the PC, was out on PC as well. So it was effectively designed on that, and then able to be ported across to the PlayStation. So yeah, it made the development so much simpler. because you had a console out there that was capable of at least, you know, going quite a far way along with the PC.
Well, obviously, you know, we did kind of mention the Saturn as well, and after the success of the Mega Drive, when, you know, Sega's next console was talked about, everyone thought, oh, you know, it's going to be another huge system as well, but Sony kind of came along and just shook everything up, you know. Sega were never the same after that. Obviously, it'd only be one more console before they were finished in the hardware market, and the Ultra 64 was delayed by about, like, 3 years. So Sony, yeah, like, they kind of came along at that moment where they had the market kind of to themselves, really, didn't they, I guess, for a couple of years?
They did. I mean, this is where you get into legend and rumor and other things. But from what I think we all know is that the Saturn was rushed out and then not properly supported. But I mean, that's the thing. We're going to be interviewing some people at Sega, so I hopefully, you know, if you ask me this question again in 6 months, I'll have a very clear answer for you. But I genuinely, when we're making a documentary, I write loads and loads and loads of questions to myself, Dan, and that's one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, I read various magazines that sort of say very assuredly that the Saturn was rushed to try and beat the PlayStation and everything else like that. But would it really have made much difference? I mean, what really went wrong with the Saturn? Could it truly compete with the PlayStation? I mean, the Saturn isn't a bad console. It's just that a lot of developers have complained that it was very, very difficult to develop for. I also will want to understand exactly how much of a threat did Nintendo perceive Sony, because obviously the legend is that when the president of Sony was so annoyed by being, not disgraced, but sort of dishonoured by Nintendo's actions, that massive resources were then dedicated to the PlayStation to make it a world beater.
An ego thing, then, yeah?
Yeah, that's the legend. I mean, that's the thing about when you take the whole... that's another thing we're looking forward to doing with this film, is bringing the Japanese into the story.
One of the biggest titles that came out on the PlayStation for me, and it showed, after 5 years of its shelf life, how upward the graphics had gone. It was Final Fantasy VII. Mm. And I think that was just a stunning piece of art. We'd never seen anything like that before.
No, of course not, and it's being remastered at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
For PS4. So yeah, it's we are obviously looking to interview those developers. Actually, we are going to Japan to interview quite a lot of those guys. I never like to say for definite beforehand, more out of superstition, but we're very hopeful that we're going to be able to get what you would consider the classic Japanese developers, the ones that you would expect to see in such a film. That's what we're aiming for, and Sony are helping us. So, you know, I'd expect to be asking those sorts of questions, certainly with regards to, is it true, what was the reason to switch from Nintendo to go to Sony with Final Fantasy VII? Because obviously that was the big switch of console for the development team. And you know, was it because it was a CD-based system, or, you know, I want to understand exactly what that switch was, because that was another huge coup for Sony, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
To get Final Fantasy VII.
I remember seeing that at the time, and it was like, you know, a Final Fantasy game coming out on a non-Nintendo system. What? It's like,
yeah,
you never thought you'd see that.
Well, there's one thing as well that I don't think anyone on the press or official would usually ask you, and this would be about the piracy with the PlayStation, because there was actually quite a big scene for mod chipping, disc swapping, and at school it was like we moved from floppy disks to CD. It was like, yeah, literally,
you couldn't do it with cartridges, could you, really?
Yeah. No.
No, well, that's the thing, isn't it? It was a CD-based system, which meant that you could burn CDs, and, you know, there were, yeah, I mean, where did piracy was, you certainly couldn't, it certainly didn't start with the PlayStation, it won't end with the PlayStation. It's it was around since the very, very early 1980s. Hackers will always look at what, you know, sometimes it's just a challenge. It's not necessarily about playing the games. Again, going back to the Amiga years, interviewing all these the demo scene people and the crackers, cracking crews, hackers, other things, they were saying to me that, do you know what, it got to the point where they were getting obsessed with cracking games and weren't playing any. it would literally be, you know, the thing that some of the copy parties, some of the hackers were literally treating it like a job. Oh, another game's cracked. It wasn't about, oh, crack it and have a really great time playing it. It was literally like a nine, almost like a 9-to-5 job to crack the games, post up the data and then move on to the next one, just to sort of prove that you cracked it before somebody else.
Sorry, one thing that I found was Sony must have been pretty confident that they would sell a lot of units because it was very easy to copy and do swap tricks, whereas the Sega Saturn, they've just cracked it this year.
Yeah.
So it's taken that long, yeah.
That's very true. I have no idea why that would be, why that was the case. I mean, you could also... Cynics out there might say not enough people bought the Saturn, so no one really cared. I think that's extremely unfair, and I don't really mean that. But PlayStation was incredibly mass market. So many people got their hands on it. It was cheap. The other thing as well, if it's a £1,000 piece of kit, you might not want to go and rip it apart so much, but a couple of £100, you know, oh, I burnt one out, I'll have to go and get another one. It leads to experimentation and other things. I think that might be another part of it. It was cheap. It was cheap and it was widely available. And it leads to experimentation. Of course, CD based system. Once you can burn your own discs and it could be cracked. You know, it was. I mean, everybody was passing copies around PlayStation games. They were everywhere, downloading them when the internet became more available. It was always a big problem, but maybe they didn't envisage that being such an issue and didn't lock it down. One thing I don't know, what was the PS2 like for that? Did that get...
It was much harder. Much harder on the PS2. You had to modify it, put in different lids and stuff, yeah.
You sound like you're talking from experience.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, you need a little piece of paper or a pen for the PS1. It was very simple.
Well, it's that top-loader system as well makes it easy, doesn't it? Yeah. But you mentioned the PS2 there as well, and that's quite, you know, obviously following up the PlayStation, which was, you know, the most successful console of the 90s. Development of the PS2 then, have you kind of learned what went into that and what kind of thought process? Or that must have been a pretty hard system to design after the PS1.
I literally know only a small amount about how the PS2 came about. Mm-hmm. So I've got a huge stack of questions to find out. I would assume by Christmas I'll know. If you look at, sorry to keep talking about older systems, but when you take something like the Atari 2600, so many of the Atari engineers were telling Atari that they needed to start developing the follow-up system to the 2600 almost immediately, because they knew that it would take a couple of years and they needed it out. And the Atari management didn't listen. So what was eventually pushed out, though good, was years and years too late. So I'd be interested to know at what point Sony really decided to start developing the PS. I know what's available on the web. Mm-hmm. I know what information's out there. But I really want to understand when was it decided, and how different were they going to try and make it? And obviously it was a huge success because, you know, we know how well the PS2's done to this day. But just rolling on slightly, some of the things that we've discovered is that the PS3 is where even in some internal Sony people felt that Sony lost their way a little bit. So they made some missteps, which by that point, by the time the PS3 came along, suddenly they already had a competitor in Microsoft.
Yeah.
And they had other things to think about. Like, in a funny sort of way, Microsoft were playing catch-up the way Sony were probably trying to enter the market when Nintendo were light years ahead. So Microsoft had been able to sit there and work out, you know, around 1999, 2000, how they're going to try to enter the market with the Xbox. So what Nicola and I are interested in when it comes to the PS3 is how was Sony swayed by what Microsoft was doing, by what the Xbox was capable of? What was in their thinking? Because though it eventually settled down, the PS3 launch announcement and launch was not smooth.
That was a disaster, wasn't it? Yeah,
of course. It was. I was being nice, but yeah, it's you know, and they made, again, not trying to curse Microsoft here, but they made some very Microsoft type announcements, if you know what I mean. They sort of behaved in a way that was a little bit like Microsoft. You would expect Microsoft to behave, where they sort of said, we're doing this, it's very expensive, but they expected people to buy it. And of course, you're reducing the price within a very short space of time, which annoyed the people that initially went out and bought it for the top price. What was it, $599? It was something, something crazy, wasn't it?
The Blu-ray drive cost a fortune, didn't it?
Well, that's the thing. They tried to... I can completely understand the reason. Just like they did with the, and we didn't really touch on this, by the way, of course, did we? The PlayStation, obviously, with the PS2, with the the DVD player.
Yeah, a lot of people bought that as a DVD player.
Of course.
They?
Yeah, I heard...
I completely stepped over that. Sorry, I should have been a lot more clear on that.
I heard the whole market in Japan was VCD before there.
Yeah.
And then PS came out and it was like the cheapest DVD player you could get. So people were just buying it for the DVD player as well.
And you got a free console included. Yeah.
Now that Sony's experience with the hi-fi and the consumer electronics market, people are buying DVD players all the time. I got a PS2 because I needed a DVD player.
Well, I think that was Microsoft's biggest screw-up with the original Xbox. That played DVDs, but you had to buy like a separate media remote to enable it. It was like, what were they thinking there?
Maybe what somebody will do a film one day, and I'm not saying this that we're doing it, but of the greatest video game mistakes.
Yeah.
Because you look at something and you think, what on earth were they thinking of? There is absolutely no excuse you could possibly make. Why would you make it so fiddly and difficult? If you make the consumer think twice about something where they have to, but you then need this piece of equipment to do that. Whereas this one here, it just works.
Yeah, HD DVD is an example of that, isn't it? Having that big chunky add-on.
That's right. That's right. And that was... Well, that was to try and because they viewed that they needed to create a because Sony obviously owned Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. For example, to make the Amiga years Blu-rays, I need a license from Sony.
By the time the Xbox One came out and Microsoft had to, pay Sony royalties for all the games on the system, that must have hurt.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Sometimes in life, you just, you have to do those things and they sting. And you've tried it, and they tried it with it. The HD system was a complete disaster. And of course, how much money? But that's the thing. One thing I will say, you could, in a funny sort of way, Sony had as could have had a, it could have been a disaster with the PlayStation.
I wonder if the success of the PS1 and then the 115 million PS2s they sold, if Sony kind of got a bit cocky. When the PS3 was announced, they thought, everyone buys PlayStations now. And that kind of early, passion and that, they kind of lost that around then?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think, but you know what? As somebody at Sony told me recently, when we were interviewing, he said that, any company can go through that. Mm-hmm. It's how you learn from that. It's what you, if you don't get it quite right, there's no point just sitting there going down with a ship. You've got to look at it and say, okay, this hasn't gone right. You're not going to get it right every time. Maybe it was overpriced. Maybe there were things that they expected. But I think the price was a big issue. I seem to remember when the PS3 came out, everybody was obsessed with the price.
Yeah.
It was price above everything else. It was sort of very against what PlayStation had been in the past, because PlayStation was always accessible and cheap.
They were putting everything in there, like memory card readers and all sorts of personal ads. Yeah. PS2 on a chip, didn't it, as well?
I'm wondering if they were actually phased by Microsoft.
Yeah,
I think that probably had a big thing to do with it. I think they obviously Blu-ray was one thing because obviously they needed to get that next. It probably irked them slightly. Again, this is only mere guessing, but it probably irked them slightly that Microsoft were coming out with a rival format. So Sony then probably felt obliged they'd have to pack in. The drive, the Blu-ray drive. So they probably thought we've got to pop this in. Maybe that was the thing that drove the cost up unnecessarily. I don't know. Hopefully, I'll find out. They did obviously. What was it? 6 months later, they slashed the price.
Yeah. Then obviously the Slim came out, and by the end of that generation, the PS3 did outsell the 360. But
it also
it was a tough mission to get.
It
there.
Also had Linux on it at the beginning as well.
You could put Linux on, yeah.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, there was a bit of OS experimentation in there as well.
Yeah, this put everything.
I'm wondering if it was Microsoft that really caused that problem. I wonder if it made them. Sometimes you sort of lose sight of what you are.
Yeah.
When you're looking at the opposition, you forget about what you're doing. Well, I suppose you've got to look at the opposition to a certain extent, but I don't know. What's happening with the Xbox One? Is the PlayStation 4 is outselling it 4-1?
I think it keeps changing. I read a couple of months ago that apparently the Xbox had outselled it in that quarter, and now they've got rid of Kinect and they've put the price down. But I think it's a pretty close race at the moment.
Now PlayStation VR may be changing that.
I think so. I've been very privileged to actually been able to see a lot of the VR stuff over the last year.
Yeah.
Because obviously when we've been making the Amiga years, we've gone to see developers that are working with VR now, top secret for the PS4. And it's, I mean, you know, I grew up in the 80s, but I remember in the 90s with the virtual reality systems with these huge televisions that you bolted to your skull, basically, that sort of, you know, broke your back trying to lift them up. And this was the new revolution, and it just died because the technology was a bit crap.
We were on it this weekend. One of those old virtuality machines. And yeah, it was really like 30 frames per second or, well, 15 I think it was, even, yeah.
But augmented reality, it's not a new thing. If you remember those, what were those old, like binoculars things that were? There were three of them. There was, you know, you put to your eyes when you were a kid.
You played one of them as well, didn't you?
Yeah, stereoscopic.
Yeah, that's it. They, you know, as a kid, I remember playing that in the playground and being absolutely blown away by, you know, this reality that you were able to see. So it's not a new thing, but I think what the challenge is how to adapt it into game design so that it becomes intuitive. So it's like it's not a gimmick, because I think gamers are very intelligent. It doesn't matter whether you're old or young. The majority of gamers, if it becomes gimmicky, forget it. You know, it's all right for a laugh for 5 minutes or 20 minutes, but it's got to be something which is actually going to improve the game experience in some way. In my humble opinion, I think there's always... I always love a controller in my hands. I love, you know, I love playing games on the Amiga or the PC, on the PlayStation. I like a controller actually to play it. But I have played some VR on the PS4, and it is a completely different experience. But it's not necessarily an experience I'd want to have every time.
Yeah.
But, you know, you wonder how you play something like FIFA with that, because obviously, yes, you can look around, I don't know, I mean, then you end up playing... first-person perspective, and you're standing in the pitch, but still you have to use your thumbs to control. It's going to change. I'm hearing things about like things that you use your feet. You know, you can literally push your feet forward, and it allows the character to walk forwards and all sorts of other things. It's very, very interesting, and it's interesting that PlayStation are very much at the front again with this new tech. We'll see how it goes out. How did we get onto VR, by the way?
I think that's fine. Well, we can't wait to hear your stories from all the people you're going to chat to in this movie. I mean, you know, the PlayStation is obviously, as we've mentioned in this like 45-minute interview, there's so much that you can cover, and so, you know, the fact that the company's still going and, you know, a lot of those guys are still involved as well, I think it'll be a really interesting history to trace. And based on your previous films, we can't wait to see what you do with this one.
Oh, thank you very much. I think it'll be a nice conclusion to the three films. Well, I think it's I truly, with all the other films, when we've gone into them, we truly have not really had a firm idea as to exactly what we're going to get. I know that sounds a bit bizarre, but if we go into it just, you know, saying, oh, we know how this happened with the PlayStation, we're just trying to sort of cut people together how we assume the story was, then we won't come out with a very good movie. Mm-hmm. I think it's got to be that we've got to be prepared to be surprised. And we don't really take anything for granted. And that's what I mean when I said there's plenty of stuff on the web. And some of them are actually genuine interviews where people have actually said, this is how it was. So we're not just dismissing it. But we like to go into these things truly trying to find out something and find little nuggets and interesting things that have not been revealed before. And that's what we're going to try and do with this. We'll try and of course, it's a great story. And I'm sure we said it'll be 90 minutes and it'll end up being 2.5 hours again.
Well, when can we expect it out then? Have you got an ETA at the moment?
Well, we actually want to have a rough cut of it together by the end of December.
Cool.
So I would say we've already said to the Kickstarter backers, we've already kindly funded it for us back in July, which seems to be the worst time in the world to actually launch a Kickstarter campaign with Brexit and all sorts of other, you know, very serious things going on in the world. So it was a very nice thing that the backers came out and backed us. But we said May 2017. We want to get it out for May 2017. It should be good, and hopefully we'll have a full roster of Sony PlayStation legends on there as well.
Can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Absolutely. Well, Anthony, thank you so much for coming on this week again. We've really enjoyed talking to you, as always.
Oh, thank you very much. It's lovely to talk to you. I'm very sorry Nicola wasn't here to be with you. She's, as I said, looking after our rather poorly son at the moment.
Completely understandable. Pass on our regards as well.
Will do. Excellent. Thank you again, guys. Thanks.